Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Today on Ask Dr. Dawn, we'll be exploring a broad range of topics, but lots of brain science is on the menu, from language learning to how dreaming changes blood flow in the brain to discovering that the human immune system may be much, much smarter than we previously understood. We'll also do a deep dive into nitric oxide, the smallest neurotransmitter of them all, and of course, answers to your questions about health science and whatever you like. Struggling to learn a new language? Well, blame it on your stable brain. A study of patients with epilepsy is helping researchers to understand how the brain manages the task of learning a new language while retaining our mother tongue. It's a bit of a tug of war. The study by neuroscientists at UC San Francisco sheds light on the age-old question of why it's so difficult to learn a second language as an adult. The somewhat surprising results gave the team a window into how the brain navigates the trade-off between neuroplasticity, that is to say, the ability to grow new connections between neurons when learning new things, and stability. Like I said, it's a bit of a tug-of-war. I'll explain in a moment. When learning a new language, our brains are somehow accommodating both these forces as they're competing with each other, said Mark Leonard, the professor of, assistant professor of neurologic surgery and a member of the UCSF Weill School of Neurosciences. By using electrodes on the surface of the brain, the researchers were able to follow high-resolution neural signals. The team found that clusters of neurons scattered through the speech cortex appear to fine-tune themselves as a listener gains familiarity with those foreign sounds. So this was really the first insights into what's changing in the brain between first hearing the sounds completely unintelligible of a foreign language and finally being able to recognize them. And this is about sound and tonality. Now, I remember a movie, and if you haven't seen it, it's worth watching. Of course, it has my guy, Antonio Banderas, who I had a serious crush on back in the 90s. But the thing about that movie was that he is an Arabic traveler back in, well, Middle Ages, basically, named Ahmed ibn Fadlan. And he is actually a historical figure. And there's a wonderful book, his book, sort of going through his journey and his travels all throughout medieval Europe. He's really, it's kind of like if Marco Polo kept a diary and came from the Arabic countries, which were more advanced scientifically and culturally at that point, to the Europe in the Dark Ages, what would you find and what would you write about? The movie's called The 13th Warrior, but there's a wonderful scene where he ends up with a bunch of Viking warriors. And he, of course, at first can't understand anything. And so they're all speaking Norse, and he's just sitting there around the fire looking at them, and they're passing mead around, and he's kind of clueless. And then gradually, and they do it beautifully in the movie, he begins to catch an English word here or there. And, you know, then word fragments and sentences, and he begins to, over the course of maybe 30 seconds, you watch them show his brain learning the language, and it's really beautiful illustration of what actually seems pretty close to happening. Now, in this research, they were looking at tonality in languages, and they used Mandarin. And I have some personal experience with Mandarin. I got to spend a couple of months in China back in the 80s. Mandarin's a tonal language. I learned just enough of it to be hilariously stupid sounding. There are four tones. One is rising, one is falling, one is flat, and the other one goes up and then down. And so that is key to being able to understand whether a word means, oh, a question mark or a horse or food. Yeah, right. So you better get that tonality right. And of course, English speakers don't learn to listen for tonality at that level. All of these volunteers had previously had brain surgery at either the UCSF Epilepsy Center or at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinic. And the reason they'd had brain surgery was to get electrodes implanted in their brains to locate the sources of their seizures so that when the loci of the seizure was found, they would burn it away and cure the seizures. They had 256 channel electrodes placed on the surface of the brains, and of course they didn't go and take those out. So they were able to use the data to look at the surface, at the brain regions that process speech sounds. So they worked with each volunteer, playing recordings of native Mandarin speakers of different ages, males and females, pronouncing syllables like ma, 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 or di, using each of the four tones. And after each sound, the patient indicated whether they thought the tone was going up, down, up, then down, or staying flat, and received feedback. Yes, that's right. No, that's not. Typical neurofeedback. They repeated the task 5 to 10 minute sessions about 200 times on each tone. So it didn't take that long for them to get good at categorizing the sounds, but what they saw was a lot of variability. Some people would get a bunch of trials right, and then they'd suddenly start getting them wrong, and then they'll get them right again. And it's almost like a push-pull. It's like the brain was fighting the plasticity. It was fighting changing. Overnight, it changed as well. It was like the brain was restoring the old settings from backup until finally enough repetition meant that the backup got updated to the new knowledge. And they also saw the emergence of little tiny centers of cortex that took over with the tonality. So you would develop a special part of the cortex that would hear the dipping tone, another that would hear the rising tone. And they could see those lighting up when the tone matched, but they were different across individuals. So every brain was learning, but it was learning in its own individual way. Now, that may be why some people are better than it at others. I think there may be some structural differences for that. But we've got a caller waiting. It's Sybil. Hello, Sybil. You're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hello.
I have a few questions,
good.
If I may.
That's quite all right. Questions is what we're all about here.
Thank you. Somebody said that if one gets the COVID booster too early, then the immune system can get lazy. Is there any truth to that, that we should wait? Or I don't know how long we should wait.
Well, okay. Let's start with the immune system doesn't get lazy when you get a vaccine too early. What happens, and I don't think this is happening with the booster interval of 3 weeks. So let's start with the way we give this, these vaccines, the two-dose vaccines at least. We wait 3 weeks or 4 weeks and then boost. And that was based on the original studies of 4,000 or 5,000 people looking at antibodies. And this is very typical for a viral vaccine, is that you need several examples. Think of a hound dog being given a handkerchief to sniff in one of those old movies where they used hound dogs to track down the fugitive. That's the kind of thing that the immune system does. You give it a sniff of the virus, and then it goes after it, but it forgets, gets distracted. Oh, wait, squirrel. So you have to give it another sniff. And that's what we do with vaccines. So when we talk about this third shot, when we say booster now, most people are talking about a third shot. And I want to emphasize, at the moment, we have no official word on what we're supposed to be doing. That's still up in the air. But what we do have is information that if a person has immunosuppression or is under cancer treatment or for any other reason has a weak immune system, they should have already gotten a third shot, because it takes three shots to get their antibodies up to where the rest of us get with two shots. So once we get up to that level, the big question is, how long does it take us for that level to drop to the point where we need more help? That's a very big question. There is some data coming out of Israel, and England already decided to start boosting people. But remember, England used the AstraZeneca vaccine, which wasn't as good in terms of the amount of immunity it created in the first place. It was good enough to do what it needed to do, which was keep people out of the hospital. But it wasn't quite as good in terms of a vigorous antibody response as the Pfizer or the Moderna were. And the Johnson & Johnson is somewhere up there with the AstraZeneca, maybe a little higher, depends on which company's literature you read. But The idea that the immune system is going to get lazy, not at all true. What would happen if you got the booster too early is you wouldn't get the full benefit because, first of all, your hound dog would still have been following the trail. And so as soon as the vaccine got into your body, it would just chew it up and attack it, which is what happens if you get a tetanus booster too early. I don't know if you've ever had that. I had somebody once get a puncture wound. It was very deep, very nasty, stool contaminated. I'm like, okay, you need another tetanus shot. It's been 2 years. Your arm is really going to hurt, but I really think you need it. So here's, you know, take your pain meds. Here's some ice and your arm's going to be really sore. And indeed it was, because where did the antigen go? The handkerchief, so to speak, went right into the muscle of the deltoid, and the immune system went straight for it and chewed it all up. Now, did they get a reviving of their immune system? Yeah. But was it necessary? Based on the amount of reaction they had, probably not. But I was playing it safe there. We don't have the data. It's as really as simple as that. We don't have the data. But the immune system's not going to get lazy. That's just not how this works. You had a couple of other questions, I think, Sybil.
Yeah. Well, how long should I wait between vaccines, the pneumonia vaccine, because I'm due for that.
Okay. And between the pneumonia vaccine and the COVID booster, you mean?
Yes.
The pneumonia vaccine itself is against something very different than a virus. Of course, pneumonia is a bacteria, and the thing that that vaccine is going after is a kind of a coating that's on the bacteria, and that's what we're vaccinating against. That coating is actually fools the immune system, so we have to tell the immune system, no, don't be fooled, that's a disguise. It is really different enough that you probably could give them at the same time, but I generally tell people, give it a couple of weeks, because we know from all of our studies that it takes a couple of weeks for the antibodies to come online. And I figure once they've come online, it's fine. You can go ahead and send out another SOS to a different set of beta cells and say, all right, you guys are up. Now start making antibody to this one. Because the cells are dedicated. It's not like there's one cell that makes a bunch of different antibodies. The cells are strictly dedicated to what you vaccinated them against or what they've been exposed to.
Okay. I have a question. I already emailed you about this earlier, but I didn't specify the types of alcohol this hand sanitizer has. And one has wood alcohol and the other is ethyl alcohol.
Okay. And so what's your question?
Okay. Are these okay to put on the hands? I don't like this
isopropyl. Isopropyl alcohol and wood alcohol are neurotoxins. So if you're going to So if you're going to put them on your hands, that's kind of okay, unless, of course, you're going to eat French fries or something like that right after. And then it may not have all evaporated, and you could potentially get some molecules that your liver and your detoxification system have to deal with. Ethyl alcohol, well, you know, that's booze. So pretty safe in all but massive doses would be my take. So if you can get an ethyl alcohol-based hand sanitizer, please send me a link where I can get some, because I would very much prefer to be using that than the stuff that I'm currently using.
The CVS has one.
And it's ethyl alcohol?
It's a spray.
Okay.
Yes,
I'll have to I'll have to check that out. Thank you very much. I would much prefer to use that. What I do now when I use a hand sanitizer is I go look for a water faucet and rinse it, because I've killed the bugs
sure.
by the time I've killed the bugs by the time I get 30 seconds out. What's going to be killed is dead. What's going to be denatured is denatured. Rinse it off so that if I do put a cough drop or a mint or something in my mouth, I'm not, you know, putting my finger full of neurotoxin in my mouth too. And that's probably paranoid. But, you know, when you're a functional medicine doctor, you walk around kind of freaked out by our pesticide, you know, plastic-filled environment. And I will totally cop to being nervous about it and doing my very best to keep my exposure to a minimum.
Exactly.
Precautionary principle, as they say.
Yeah. And can I ask you a couple questions about two supplements? The first one is SAMI. Like, I use it for detox, you know, smoke pollution. Is that a good idea? And maybe there's other benefits of SAMI. I mean, there's supposed to be a lot. But how much do I, should I take of FAMI? And there's one, and the other one is NAC. I don't know how much to take from each.
All right. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about detox. And it's a big topic, and I'm just going to give you the executive satellite view here. But there are a bunch of nutrients that are used in various ways to get rid of crap. And this is the crap that we make, like a broken down estrogen molecule, or it's the crap that we inhale, like air pollution. And there are different pathways, and there's a bias for particular things to be pulled into particular pathways for disposal. If you're eating a good diet with lots of fruits and vegetables, you are getting most of the nutrients that you need. But there is a lot of genetic variation in terms of our detox. And so where we run into trouble is if a person has a certain genetic variant that makes it hard for them to use dietary folic acid, like supplement folic acid, and you give them supplements, you could actually burden their system rather than unburden it. And in the case of SAMe, SAMe provides methyl groups, and it's one of the major methyl donors. And methylation is important for making your neurotransmitters like your serotonin and your dopamine. And it's important for getting rid of, among other things, a lot of environmental pollutants, a lot of plastic, a lot of endocrine imitators. I don't like the word endocrine disruptors. I feel it's almost political and not sufficiently rigorous, but we'll call them hormone imitators or hormone mimics, which you get from the environment plus your own hormones. So methylation is really important. When you talk about smoke, methylation can help get rid of the byproducts of smoke inhalation. So that's a reasonable strategy. Another thing that's really helpful is garlic and onions and leeks and broccoli and the crucifers, because they provide sulfur, which is, you know, it's like methylation and sulfur, man, that's the tag team. And between the two of them, they'll get rid of almost anything. And so if you've got one bad set of DNA, the other one takes over. So it's a good combo. In terms of amounts, 400 IUs of SAMe is a fairly typical supplement dose for, you know, general support. 1,600 a day, that's usually in two divided doses of 800 and 800. Most people can manage twice a day, is actually fairly effective for treating some forms of depression, because it's probably raising serotonin levels. So I'll often use that in people for mental health stabilization. And that's safe for long-term use. I wouldn't go above that dose. You know, obviously, this is general purpose advice. So I'm looking at what's been given to people without causing trouble. But there might be somebody that dose would cause trouble for. You know, that, so if it doesn't feel right, don't keep taking it. Your other question was about NAC. NAC is N-acetylcysteine. It's basically an amino acid with an acetate group on it, which is, you know, just a couple of carbons and some hydrogens. But it has a lot of chemical benefit because it helps your body make glutathione. And glutathione is also really important for free radical scavenging. So it gets rid of all those little pesky oxygen-free radicals, which are coming off of our chemical reactions, just like sparks come out off of a flame, and they're just as bad as, you know, when a spark from the campfire lands on your jacket, it burns a hole in it. Well, one of these free radicals lands on your cell, it burns a hole in it, can also burn a hole in your DNA, causing a mutation, happens all the time. We spend a lot of energy correcting errors in our DNA that are made by free radicals and cosmic rays and all the other stuff that happens in physiology. So 500 milligrams a couple times a day is a good dose for NAC. Interestingly enough, I actually had a story about NAC. I'm going to pivot to it because it's germane to your topic. It looks like the FDA is actually going to be limiting NAC. Let's just say that some less than scrupulous supplement people have been promoting it online as a hangover cure. So alcohol depletes glutathione. You use up glutathione getting rid of alcohol, but there's no evidence that it's a hangover cure. And obviously, when you promote something as a hangover cure, you're effectively encouraging people to drink. So they sent out a letter to all of those companies, which is fine. I mean, that's not an appropriate thing. But after they did that, this was back in May of this year, Amazon basically said, we're pulling all the NAC from all of our digital shelves. We're not going to sell it anymore because, you know, Amazon's in enough trouble as it is, and they don't really want to have the FDA breathing down their neck. So totally get it. But the supply may dry up. It wouldn't surprise me if other large retailers, you know, the Walmarts of the world, also decided they just didn't want any of that. And it's kind of like, why now? NAC's been around since before the 1960s. It was approved as a new drug in 1963. It's been around for 60 years, but it's always been used in supplements for like 50 years. We use it IV in the hospital for liver damage. Somebody ODs on Tylenol and tries to kill themselves with a Tylenol overdose. This will bring them back. It resuscitates the liver. And we also use it in certain kinds of lung disease because it thins the mucus. I have some people breathing it who have thick, gooey mucus. They use it with a nebulizer, a little machine that works great, helps break up that mucus. And I have a couple of other people nebulizing it to help with inflammation. And it actually works quite well, totally off-label. I hope that the inhalable forms don't disappear. Yeah, so what's going on here? I don't know. This article, which is, of course, a paranoid article in Holistic Primary Care, says, well, maybe it's because NAC's being used as a COVID treatment, and there are pharmaceutical companies who don't want it to be available over the counter. And maybe they're right. Maybe the fix is in. Or it could be totally innocent because of the hangover cures. Hard to know. Anyway, I would say stock up.
And if I use a SAMI not for depression, how much should I take?
About 400 to 800 a day, I would say.
Okay.
For your
okay.
detox purposes.
Yeah, great. Okay, thank you so much, Dr. Don.
You're very welcome. So thank you for the call. We covered a lot of ground, and I'm glad I had that article sitting here. Quite handy.
Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye-bye.
So let's pick up on Sybil's topic and go to this email from Annie in Arizona. And Annie writes, natural immunity after COVID infection. Hi, Dr. Don. Thanks again for all your services and words of wisdom, which so many of us appreciate. Thanks again for all your service. I was wondering if you could please comment on the following study from Israel, demonstrating that natural immunity confers longer lasting and stronger protection against infection, symptomatic disease, and hospitalization caused by the Delta variant of SARS-CoV-2, comparing two-dose Pfizer vaccine immunity. I am very aware that this is a preprint and not peer-reviewed as of this point. However, it's of interest to me. I heard about it on a reputable podcast, Doctor Radio, Sirius XM, from NYU Langone Health, which I agree is a reputable podcast. Here is the link to the study. We'll talk about the study in a moment. Annie's question. I am vaccinated and a strong believer in vaccination of all kinds, and I'm curious how much natural immunity unvaccinated folks have after a COVID infection, because I have a friend in exactly that situation. Thanks so much. Well, first of all, Annie, I want to say that I have a very distinct memory of walking along Pajaro Dunes Beach back in 2020 when the first report came out of somebody getting COVID for the second time. And it was about 6 months after his first case of COVID. He'd been one of the early people. So it had to be summer of 2020. And he made a trip to Italy, I believe. And in the airport, he screened out as having COVID-19. But he had, you know, PCR-proven COVID-19 back in February. So he wasn't sick. He felt fine. He had cleared the virus, and now he had it again. So we know that that can happen with people who are naturally immune, and this is way before we even have a vaccine. So the article in question was, as she said, a preprint. It's called Comparing SARS-CoV-2 Natural Immunity to Vaccine-Induced Immunity. There are a few things wrong with this from a biological standpoint. I actually don't think it's going to get through peer review. First of all, it was a retrospective observational study, and that means they went and dug up the people after the fact. And so they had three groups, people who got the two-dose Pfizer vaccine, people who got infected, who were not vaccinated, and then people who had gotten infected and then had a single dose of vaccine effectively as a booster. And they looked at, did they get COVID again? What was their chance of symptomatic disease? What was their chance of hospitalization and death? And this is during the time of the Delta variant. So I want to emphasize they're assuming that we're talking about resistance to Delta. Obviously, the vaccine was based on a different strain. And here's one of the flaws in this, methodologically, in my opinion, is they really didn't know whether the people who had previously had COVID had had, in fact, Delta. And we just can't know that. But what they did see was that the people who had had SARS did better with Delta than the people who got the vaccine. So the having actually had COVID itself gave you more and better immunity. Okay, great. So far as it goes, doesn't surprise me. In general, vaccines require booster shot at intervals that we discover over time. And we're currently, as I said to Sybil, in the middle of a big debate about what that interval needs to be. A good historical example is measles. Natural immunity to measles is lifelong. You never need another vaccine. But originally, once we got the measles vaccine, we gave it once. This starts back in the 1960s. Fast forward 20 years later, and we start learning about an entity called atypical measles. I'm talking about my generation here. I got the measles vaccine in grade school, and then I was in medical school, and we started seeing people in my age cohort get this weird version of measles, which was really severe and affected the brain and filled the lungs up with fluid. It had the rash, but it was like you got the worst possible measles. We went back and we revaccinated everybody. So now two shots are routine. And when the generation that's had two shots hits their 30s and 40s, which will be sometime next decade, we'll see. So your question is really premature, right? You see that now. But a couple of interesting factoids. A recent study on natural infection was looked at the lymph nodes at about 6 to 12 months after a prior COVID infection in patients. And what they found was that the antibodies that people were making 6 to 12 months out were different in character than the antibodies that they were making earlier. The ones earlier were very specific to the strain of COVID they caught. Later on, it's almost like the immune system kept a record of the virus and kept experimenting with new different antibodies and building better and better antibodies, which I don't think we were really aware that that was a thing. I find it fascinating. There was another study that came out of Singapore. I covered it on the show 2 to 3 weeks ago, and it showed that people in Singapore who had SARS-CoV-1 back 20 years ago, who were vaccinated with the Pfizer vaccine, did something really unexpected. Their immune systems seemed to really go nuts after receiving, like they got a huge grant from the government. After they got that second SARS-2 spike protein vaccine, they went through a massive creative burst and began making a wide variety of neutralizing antibodies. And these antibodies, maybe because they had, you know, they were able to triangulate on SARS, it covered the animal versions of SARS. It covered all of the versions that we have self cultures for, like the Lambda, which I haven't had to tell you about yet, thank God, but there's a whole bunch of them. There's Iota. Seriously, we're going to run out of Greek letters. So that neutralizing antibody that happened with a second exposure to a different SARS, that's really fascinating. Another study suggested that lymph tissue in the gut actually kept a non-infectious version of COVID virus around for at least 6 to 12 months after the infection. And the gut as well seemed to be making second and third generation antibodies that were different than the ones we typically initially see. So our take home here is that the adaptive immune system is just that, very adaptable and much smarter than most of us realize. Who knows? Maybe we should formulate a two-virus vaccine with SARS-1 and SARS-2 and give the immune system something to chew on that might cover all of the potential variants in the future. Certainly something worth thinking about. So let's pick up where we left off with new brain science. And this one, quite interesting to me and absorbs to people in my age cohort in general, I think. Scientists reverse age-related memory loss in mice. Scientists at Cambridge and Leeds universities have successfully reversed age-related memory loss and say their discovery could lead to the treatment, to the development of treatments to prevent memory loss in people as they age. And we talked about neuroplasticity and that wrestling match, tug of war that the cells were having in the language learners. Well, In a study published back in July in Molecular Psychiatry, the team showed that changes in the extracellular matrix of the brain, the kind of scaffolding that holds up the nerve cells, lead to memory loss with aging, but these can be reversed using genetic treatments. They're talking about something called perineuronal nets, or PNNs. PNNs are cartilage-like structure that mostly surround inhibitory neurons in the brain. The brain works by inhibiting excitation. Sounds like a real buzzkill, doesn't it? But their main effect is to control the level of plasticity in the brain. They aren't there in the first 5 years of life, which, by the way, if speaking of language learning, if three or four languages are floating around in your environment before the age of five, you'll have a really easy time learning languages for the rest of your life. So, parents, take note. At about the age of five, these PNNs start showing up in the brain. They turn off that period of enhanced plasticity, during which all of those connections are optimized. As the plasticity is turned off, the brain becomes more efficient and faster, but also less flexible in terms of new learning. In the PNNs, there are compounds called chondroitin sulfates. Chondroitin sulfate? Wait a minute. Can't I go buy that at Costco for my arthritis? Well, yes, but it gets, would you believe, more complicated than that? Some of the chondroitin sulfates inhibit the networks, which means they inhibit neuroplasticity, and some of them actually promote neuroplasticity. And the balance of these compounds is what actually allows the brain and the brain development to be fine-tuned. So the team looked at 20-year-old mice. That's very ancient, and they compared them to 6-month-old mice. And they wanted to see whether the mice recognized an object. So they had a Y-shaped maze. They had either a new object or a repeated object, took them out of the maze, put them back in, and they wanted to see the amount of time the mouse spent looking at the object, because if it remembered the object from previously, it wouldn't look at it very long and be, oh, that, and moving on. That's not food. Let's keep looking. So they then treated the aging mice using a viral vector. This is basically a virus that was able to put the enzymes to create more of the 6-sulfate chondroitin into the brain, essentially like a syringe containing DNA or RNA, I'm not sure which they used here, that got squirted into the mouse brain, and lo and behold, it found its way into the genome, found its way into the ribosome, and managed to get created. So now we have more of this 6-chondroitin, and the old mice had their memory restored. They went on to play around with making knockout mice, because that's what you do. They made mice that were only able to produce low levels of the compound, and surprise, surprise, even when they were only 11 weeks old, these mice were having old mice-type memory problems. This would be all academic, right, and take years and years to do something, but there's actually a drug out there, licensed for human use, that is orally taken, getting better and better, and it inhibits the formation of PNNs. So, of course, this has to be looked at, but they gave it to mice and rats, and it seemed to restore memory, and it also seemed to help with spinal cord injury. So maybe inhibiting the formation of these PNNs allows the brain to revert back to that previously highly plastic state, which of course would allow it to more easily repurpose neurons, just like we saw in the temporal lobe of the language learners. So some pretty interesting stuff out there. And wait, there's more. Extremely premature infants are at a very high risk for brain damage, and researchers have found possible targets for early treatment of such damage outside the brain. It turns out, surprise, surprise, bacteria in the gut of the premature infants may play a key role. the team found that overgrowth of the GI tract with the bacterium Klebsiella is associated with an increased presence of certain immune cells and the development of neurological loss in preterm babies. These early premature babies are at very high risk for brain damage. And we know that Klebsiella, while it's considered a possible pathogen in the gut by standard medicine, is a pro-inflammatory pathogen, and you ordinarily would not find it in the gut of an infant in very high levels. But premature infants are often, they have to be fed special formulas. The mother hasn't got, there isn't enough breast milk for them. Their digestive tract is very underdeveloped, and they may need pre-digested foods, and that's going to act as substrate for a completely different set of bacteria. And nobody's really willing to do a lot of research with probiotics and premature babies. I mean, the liability on that is huge. It's just not going to happen. It's too bad, because it's starting to look like maybe that's exactly what does need to happen. We know that the brain and the immune system are closely interrelated. The bacteria in the gut cooperate with the immune system. The immune system monitors the gut microbes. The vagus nerve connects the gut and the brain. This axis plays a role in brain development of extreme premature babies. It's as if the immune system and the microbiome are not fully there, so the normal brain development can't happen. And they've been able to actually identify some fingerprints of certain patterns in the microbiome. These patterns show up prior to the changes in the brain, so there may be a critical time window in which the brain damage can be prevented from worsening or even avoided. The big culprit seems to be too much Klebsiella. So they were able to track these down by exploring this specific group of babies. They used microbiome 16S RNA sequencing. That's the standard, and you can get a 16S RNA sequence of your gut flora for a couple hundred bucks now from a number of labs. They also looked at brainwave recordings and MRI images of the newborns, and they saw this really significant variation. If they had the Klebsiella, they did not develop normally. If they didn't have it, they did. Now, the question is, how can we manipulate this? Because these brain changes are apparent through these sorts of studies, but we really don't develop sufficiently for them to be identified clinically for several more years. So being able to head this off at the pass is a potentially major game changer. More about mice microbiota. This study looked at fecal microbiota transplantation, and they used either 3 to 4 month old mice or 19 to 20 year old mice, and they donated, those were the stool donors, and then they transplanted the stool to aged mice. When they transplanted the microbiota from young donors, they reversed aging-associated differences in the brain and in the periphery and the hippocampus and the transcriptome. So that means what DNA was being transcribed changed back to the younger pattern. And they also saw an improvement in age-associated cognitive impairment. So is the microbiota driving that PPN that influences the scaffolding around the nerve cells, or is it another mechanism entirely? Stay tuned, and I guess we'll have more for you about that in a little while. But that's what we do here. Follow up these stories kind of as threads over time. We're going to take a couple more emails now. This from April in Texas. Alkaline water. Dear Dr. Don, I loved your shows. I wanted to ask you for your thoughts on alkaline water, especially Kangen brand, the machine that you install at home to access to alkaline water. It is claimed to be a medical device allowed at the airport checkpoint, used by many doctors and hospitals in Japan, great for diabetes, sleep, etc. But I couldn't find many trials on it. But I heard lots of testimonials about how great it is. Would you give me your thoughts on it? Any harm of drinking it for a long time? Any benefits? Thanks so much. So, no harm. in paying a lot of money to alkalinize your water. We're going to be talking at length about this after I read the second email. But you can alkalinize your water really cheaply, April, and you probably have some in your refrigerator. Yes, Arm & Hammer baking soda, or for that matter, any other brand of baking soda. Is there any other brand of baking soda? A pinch of that in a liter of water, and you have alkalinized your water without expense or need to carry a device. Plus, you can get it not only in Japan, but just about anywhere on the planet. Our second email comes from Liz. Liz writes, as a 62-year-old female with osteoporosis, I recently came upon this document from a highly reputed medical institution. Due to the alpha-gal allergy from a tick bite, as well as long-standing dairy intolerance, I avoid dairy products. Therefore, I've been taking high-quality, one hopes, calcium supplement for years. Do you have an opinion on the claim that calcium supplements can actually be detrimental, that they do not, in fact, fortify bones? Is supplementation with D3 and K2 alone a better approach? Without eating dairy or calcium supplements, is it possible to ingest enough dietary calcium for healthy bones? I walk briskly on a daily basis, and when I get my osteoarthritis more manageable, we'll again be using light hand weights. Thank you so much for your service. I enjoy learning from you and the way you geek out on science. Yes, I do, on your podcast. Best regards, Liz. Okay, Liz, answering your questions and also April's, because they are very related. Let's start with the article, Calcium Supplements. It's called Should You Really Take Them? I would say yes, with a caveat, and we'll come to that in a moment. But in the article, they quote Dr. Aaron Michos, who's director of cardiology, saying, the truth is the research is inconclusive. And then he cites a 2016 article by herself suggesting that calcium supplements may increase the risk of calcium buildup in the heart's arteries. And yes, indeed, there are articles that suggest that. But again, that's not conclusive either. The fact is that damaged arteries will tend to accumulate calcium, whether you're on calcium supplements or not. If you have that genetics and you're taking calcium supplements, you will probably have more calcium buildup. The question is that since that genetics is not universal, what generalized conclusions, if any, can we draw? There have been multiple studies that have found no benefit for the prevention of hip fractures to calcium. And I'll tell you, there's a bunch of drugs out there that also don't have data for the prevention of hip fractures, but they're still marketed for that. Kidney stones, yes, absolutely. If you take calcium supplements and you don't drink enough water, you're at risk for calcium kidney stones. The body just can't process more than 500 milligrams of calcium at a time. So I typically tell people, don't ever take more than 500 milligrams. If you are taking supplements, you know, take that maybe at night, which is when your body is more likely to absorb it. Take it with maybe a little acid, swallow of orange juice or something. That's probably a really good strategy. You do need adequate levels of vitamin D, and I try to tell people to get, I tell people to try to get their levels of D3 to about 40 to 60 on a blood test. And I don't recommend using more than 5,000 units a day to get there. It might take you a year to get there. That's all right. You have time. Vitamin K2 has clearly been shown to prevent arterial calcification. But what's the best dose? Well, we're still at the drawing board on that one. Can a person get enough calcium from diet for healthy bones? Absolutely. As a postmenopausal woman, you're going to want to get about 1,200 milligrams a day. All the beans are pretty high in calcium, including soybeans, and almonds are very high. So doing a soy or an almond-based beverage, a couple glasses of that a day. There's soy yogurt. That might be another strategy. A bean meal a couple times a week sounds like a plan. And you could try mapping out a menu. Go to this website. It's my recommendation, myfooddata.com. This is a non-commercial website that has great tables. It'll allow you to look up foods high in calcium by serving size, so you can figure out how you're going to construct a higher calcium diet. If you can't quite get there, maybe take 250 milligrams twice a day with some vitamin K2, And again, that's a lot of what you need to do for your bones. But let's rethink osteoporosis, too, by looking at some of the other factors that contribute to it. And this is why this dovetails with April's article. Because chronic metabolic acidosis, which you get basically from a poor diet, can cause osteoporosis. Bone is really sensitive to even small changes in pH. So if the pH dips by even one-tenth of a point, let's say from 7.02 to 7.015, that's going to cause the bone dynamic to change. It's basically going to cause calcium to come out of the bone to balance that acidity. That stimulates the osteoclasts, the bone breakdown cells, to get in there and start chipping away at your bone. It also inhibits osteoblasts, which are also awake in your bone, and they would be grabbing calcium out of the bloodstream. And of course, they're inhibited and putting it into bone, but they're inhibited because the calcium needs to leave so it can buffer the pH. So you accelerate the loss of bone mineral density. This is one of those things where the alkaline diet comes in, the idea of eating a diet that's high in fruits and vegetables. Now, one way you can figure out about that is to check your morning pH with pH paper. And you want to get the pH paper that tests from 5.5 to 8 because it has more colors in that range. And so you'll be able to actually get an accurate read. And after you've slept at least 6 hours, that first morning urine will give you at least a sense for whether you are really acidic. Now, a lot of people argue that this isn't a great test. I still use it in mysterious cases of osteoporosis where I can't find anything else, and I think it's a legitimate thing to do. Little known fact, citrus fruits like oranges, lemon juice, things like that, they're actually alkalinizing because breaking down citrate, maleate, succinate, and fumarate, which are in citrus, actually makes twice as much bicarbonate as there is acid in the food itself. So you have a net gain in bicarbonate. You know, limit dietary sugars, limit refined flours because they are acidic. Avoid pro-inflammatory omega-6 oils like corn and soybean. And eat fish oil is good. Flax seeds are good. Those are the things you want to be doing. The other thing we want to talk about is oxidative stress and stress hormones. You need to get enough vitamin C. Those free radicals that are generated by poor diet, by other stressful factors in the environment, including pollution, you want to get enough vitamin C. That's the master antioxidant. And if you've got bad bones or you're worried about that, 1,000 milligrams a day, maybe some quercetin, maybe some blueberries, those are going to help you. And you've got to control your stress because high cortisol interferes with osteoblasts, turns them down, dramatically impairs bone building. And so people with low serotonin are going to have problems as well in maintaining their bone mass. So being happy and low stress actually helps you build better bones. Who knew, right? Okay, we're going to go to our last caller. We've got just a minute or two. I believe I have Christine on the line. Christine, are you there?
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Okay.
I have a quick question regarding osteoporosis. I was diagnosed with CRPS, which is chronic regional pain syndrome, after a fracture, and my right hand has pretty severe osteoporosis, but I don't have it in my hip or spine.
Right.
Is there any recommendations other than the obvious ones that you've mentioned, which are very helpful, for targeting specific areas of osteoporosis within your skeletal structure?
I would look at two things. You know, full disclosure, I'm an acupuncturist, and there are acupuncture treatments for osteoporosis. And typically what we do is we electrify it. We put a needle down to the level of the bone, and we electrify it. And we put another needle in a muscle group, which would probably be the base of your thumb or one of your forearm muscles. That seems to turn on the osteoblastic cells. And there's been some data out of China and Japan, which isn't, you know, nobody believes anything coming out of China and Japan in the American medical system, but I think it's legit. Use of a tuning fork or another vibratory device, and, you know, a low pitch tuning fork, it's going to vibrate the bones. Get one. And spend, you know, when you're watching TV or something, you know, spend half an hour a day striking the tuning fork and vibrating your bones. We know that vibrating the bones will stimulate bone growth. The reason you're not getting that is because the nerves are messed up. The cells aren't getting the right signal. So maybe you can override that with the vibration. These are completely off the cuff, won't hurt, might help suggestions. And I'd suggest that you monitor the density if you do decide to go the tuning fork route or the acupuncture route. Monitor it and see how it does. Who knows? You might find that you're actually turning it around and it won't hurt you. So give it a shot.
Great. Thank you for your advice. We appreciate your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.